Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit won't be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
We're coming to you live from WRBG Radio. Tonight we got a special speaker for you. He's up and coming artist. He's one of the new leaders and starting trends. Hold on one moment.
Hey, man, they ready for you, bro. Yeah, they ready. Everybody in there.
Attention, all soldiers, come gather formation. My African warriors to my thugs and gangsters. It's time to fight hard, cause our life is in danger. Stop practicing on each other and get the ones that's a gangster. It's time to link up and form one big army. Unite all of our numbers, get them people up off us. This whole thing designed to get you broke or you locked up. But we gon' tear it down because this world belongs to us. I see more twisted steps, ripping coats for the devil. You can see death in line, you got nine, what you saw. Circulate the black dollar, keep the black dollar black. We were taught by master not to have each other back. Now we linking with each other, help each other stack, stack. Black pride, one nation, strong and black. See that job that you seek, it ain't all that it seems. They tryna really let your Black Wall Street dream. You gon' make it all happen like a king and a queen. But when you rep the culture, it ain't hard as it seems. We gon' march like Martin by the window like X. We gon' free our people by enemies next. Since the last of Queen Omega showed us that we're royalty. And garments like the bread and bars are supposed to set us free. When I march, but they step ripping, come to the death. We gon' see you pass the lies, you got lies. They bring guns, they bring dope, alcohol to the hood. They want you to sell dope, kill and rob for your food. But they ain't bring no jobs, so people dying for the food. It's Operation Us and we gon' operate on us. When I say march, you say step, rep and come to the death. You can see past they lies, you got knowledge yourself. Use a king, use a queen, to your people, use a savior. If you don't know your culture, come and let me activate ya.
The world is divided into many, many different categories, but one of the categories which interests those of us who are concerned with advancing humanity the most is that between the conscious and the unconscious. This division between the conscious and the unconscious must be properly understood. The people instinctively love freedom. And they will instinctively fight freedom. But you cannot win freedom on instincts. You can only win freedom on reason. Therefore, the unconscious are those who react on instinct. The conscious are those who react on reason. The job of the conscious is to make the unconscious conscious. Let us make a simple example. I think it was in 1992, after one more brutal beatings too many, the African population in Los Angeles, California, revolted, rose up in righteous rebellion. This was instinctively revolutionary. Instinctively in the sense that it wasn't planned. Instinctive in the sense that it was this reaction to brutality. And this instinctive revolutionary act was very costly to American capitalism. It even had to bring in the American army, very costly. But since it was on instinct, it had no reason, nothing to direct it, it would spin itself out. Those who participated were largely unconscious. We must come to understand that the overwhelming majority of our people are unconscious. But just because they're unconscious, you shouldn't think they don't want freedom. As a matter of fact, sometimes the unconscious is quicker willing to give their lives in struggle than the conscious. These are simple facts. Would you imagine what it would be like when we are conscious rebellions, when we consciously organize to rebel in Los Angeles with reason? I mean, making supply lines, making sure armaments are there, having hospital aid, having fire brigades, just like they do even in Ireland. Nothing big, just a little planning. Just a little planning. This is what we want to speak to you about this evening. Making the unconscious conscious. Now we must say from the very beginning, the only, underline the word only, the only route to consciousness is through struggle. Now, for example, we've shown you the unconscious struggle. Those who rose up in righteous rebellion against the state police in Los Angeles, they were consciously involved in struggle. They were involved in struggle, unconscious, but involved in struggle. The conscious must understand precisely what their task is, and we've said this 2 years ago here, we repeat it. Ours is not to teach the people to be conscious, but to make them conscious of their unconscious behavior. Our task is not to teach the conscious to teach the unconscious to be conscious, but to make them conscious of their unconscious behavior. Because unconsciously, instinctively, they seek freedom. What we must do is make them conscious. Look, you want freedom anyway. Let's be serious. Let's sit down. Let's plan it. Let's wage protracted war, and let's tear down the system and walk on to liberation. It's as simple as that. This aspect of the unconscious becoming conscious is linked to mobilization and organization, something we mentioned last year. We must make clear distinctions between mobilizers and organizers. To be an organizer, you must be a mobilizer. But being a mobilizer doesn't make you an organizer. Much confusion is to be found here. Malcolm X was a great mobilizer. He was a great organizer. Martin Luther King was a great mobilizer. He was not a great organizer. These facts can be easily seen from King and Malcolm. When Malcolm went to a place, he left a mosque. When King went to demonstrations, he broke down desegregation and he moved on. As a matter of fact, King was not concerned with organization to the point that even though he was the most popular Baptist preacher in America without the shadow of a doubt, and probably beyond the shadow of a doubt the most loved, he could not become president of the Baptist, National Baptist Convention. Yeah, so many of them. The National Baptist Convention. As a matter of fact, if my memory serves me correctly now, and I remember it was Muhammad Speaks that carried the article on the front page in 1964 when King tried to become president of the National Baptist Convention. There was so much confusion there that a minister was actually pushed off the stage and died in the struggle.
Yeah.
And of course, King lost. The man who won was a reactionary man by the name of Jackson. He never did nothing for the people, never cared about the people, just was a pork chop minister who used their money to put gas in his big Cadillac. But he was organized. We say that we must come to know the difference between mobilization and organization because the enemy will use mobilization to demobilize us. Mobilization is very easy. Very, very easy. Because since we're people who are instinctively ready to respond against acts of injustice, anytime there's one little act of injustice, we can blow it up and we'll find people who come and make some mass demonstration around it. Miss Sally lost her job. Let's rally. She'll get her job back. People will come and rally. So-and-so got kicked out of school because the teacher's unjust. The people will come and rally. They will come to rally at issues. And this is what mobilization does. It mobilizes people around issues. Those of us who are revolutionary are not concerned with issues. We're concerned with the system. The difference must be properly understood. Mobilization usually leads to reform action, not to revolutionary action. If we would look scientifically at the October 16 million and more march, we would see clearly that this was a mobilized event, not an organized event. We must know clearly the difference between mobilization and organization. One of the characteristics of mobilization is that it is temporary. Organization is permanent and eternal. Clear differences must be made because the unconscious can usually be captured easily around one issue items, around mobilization items, but it's hard to catch them around organization. But these unconscious must be brought to organization. We must transform mobilization to organization. We say the enemy will come and use mobilization to demobilize us. Many brothers and sisters who've been to the Million and More March will say to you, I was there. Well, what are you doing today, my sister? I was there. There weren't too many sisters out there, but you know, with a million brothers together, you know where I had to be. I was there. And then, of course, you find brothers, yeah, I was there. I was there. I helped you. What are you doing today, brother? If we're not careful, we allow mobilization to become events. The struggle is never an event. It's a process, a continual, eternal process. We say it is our job to use mobilization to drive us to organization. You know our theme is organization. We want power. We don't want money. We don't want fame. We don't want fortune. We don't want popularity. We want power. Power. And power comes only from the organized masses. power comes only from the organized masses.
Yes. Power only comes from the organized masses. Welcome to our Keep It Line News Show. I am your combat reporter, Brother Tutmos Sankara, here on your news platform, bringing you this political information in regards to the bringing into consciousness the unconscious. And so on that path of liberation, Brother Kwame Ture starts us off. He gets us in the mood for a struggle in regard to what it is that we are doing. And what it is that we're doing this evening is developing and furthering a theory that has been established from our ancestors and our elders and comrades in revolutionary struggle. And that is the foundation of an African revolutionary political philosophy. Coming from the West, being Africans who have been culturalated and formulated and captured and matriculated in the Western Hemisphere, we have a certain perspective in regards to revolutionary struggle and that history that comes from the local and regional and national examples of African revolutionary struggle that we can draw from here in the United States. And then there are those international examples too. And so we want to draw from this evening both of those perspectives in regards to understanding what is the foundation, African fundamental revolutionary political philosophy that we as organizers, as activists, as revolutionaries should promote, organize around, and make as a foundational principle for the organizational struggles that we are involved in as a people. And so to do that, since we're coming from the diaspora, I'd like to begin with Garvey, where within his volume, Life and Lessons, he gives us, from our perspective as Africans, that viewpoint on what during those days was termed Negro nationalism, which we understand today as being African nationalism. The culmination of the efforts of the UNIA must end in Negro or African independent nationalism, and if I can, I will, where he says Negro, if I'm allowed that platitude to interject that word in those places where he says Negro. The culmination of all the efforts of the UNIA must end in African independent nationalism on the continent of Africa. That is to say, everything must contribute towards the final objective of having a powerful nation for the African race. African nationalism is necessary. It is a political power and control. No race is free until it has a strong nation of its own in its own system of government and its own order of society. Never give up this idea. Let no one persuade you against it. It is the only protection of your generation and race. Hold on to the idea of an independent government and nation so long as other men have them. Never be satisfied to always live under the government of other people, because you shall ever be at their mercy. Visualize for yourself and your children and generations unborn of the race, your own king, your own emperor, your own president, your own government officials and administrations who look like you. God never could have intended to make you as you look and as you are, and to make your king, president, emperor, and ruler different to you in race. This must be a license for you to disobey the laws of kings of other races or rulers of other races while you live under their control. Let me say that again, Garvey. This must not be a license for you to disobey the laws of kings of other races or rulers of other races while you live under their control, but you must always seek and work for a government of your own, absolutely, where you and your children will have a chance, like anybody else in the state, to rise from the lowest to the highest position, which you may not attain under other government, but while you will have under alien government to get the best out of them as your citizenship's right, but always have in view doing something to make it possible for your race to have a nation and a government of its own. So, and seeking to form that nation and government of our own, and understanding that we have to put together the foundational principles building upon that has been already set forth by our ancestors, but knowing that we have to add those nuances of technology and the history that has developed since the time of those ancestors to make a true high-tech, technological, modern, revolutionary force that can carry out power, that has control of technology and systems of society, and foot soldiers on the ground that they can go forward with, right? So looking at what it is that the philosophy is coming from Garvey told you, you have to have a nation. You can't stop until you got one. That don't mean do what is the best thing to do is get from up under them. Yeah, you got to fight them while you're there, right? True enough. And, of course, as we know, Garvey did. But the main goal is to get from up under them, right? And when you get from up under them, then you have to have together the plan of action, the development of the philosophy, the economic, political, social system that will be developed that best fits that geographical area, wherever it is that you will be repatriating to, or wherever it is that you will be establishing this coordinated effort, right? And so, as we do often, we look to Africa because, of course, on the African continent, these examples of government and socialism have been developed to its zenith in regards to African people. And in the foundation of these nations, the independence explosion in the continent of Africa, among all the documents that were written, there's one that really set forth the blueprint for Africa going forward in economic, social, and political independence. It wasn't followed by a lot of nations. But, as I said, we have to understand how to take these principles, these things that have been laid forth, put the new African spin on it, and present it back to our people in a cogent, organized formation. And so what we do here is look at those philosophies and see how these things can be further implemented. In Tanzania, Brother Julius Nyerere was very successful in regard to the development of that nation. I mean, think about it today. Tanzania, free from the internal conflict that other nations have, for the most part, independent, economically viable, I mean, and politically revolutionary. Remember, Baba Geronimo Jijaga went and transitioned in Tanzania, coming straight out of prison, looking for a country in Africa. I know some of the comrades that was working around that case. They were able to get him home so that he could transition on the continent of his ancestors, right? So Tanzania had a original president after their independence by the name of Julius Nyerere. who was a very futuristic thinking African. And in this document that was written called the Arusha Declaration, the capital of Tanzania is no longer Arusha, but Arusha is still the spiritual center, the ancestral center, where the laws and philosophy of that people come down. And so Nyerere was able to go into that ancient political philosophy of his people, and what he came up with was socialism. And the document that he laid forth is called the Arusha Declaration. The party of Julius Nyerere is called the Tanzania African National Union. You will notice that in Southern Africa, oftentimes they would take on this, that you had ZANU, the Zimbabwe African National Union, right? And you had ZAPU, Zimbabwe African Patriotic Union. So these movements, of course, well, as I'm discussing now, Zimbabwe, we took place further after the 60s and the 80s when they finally achieved their liberation, took on the same model. This was the socialist model. This is the model that Julius Nyerere set forth. And he implemented it as part of the government, the Tanzania African National Union. Some of these points, the part one, they have the TANU Creed. It says the policy of TANU is to build a socialist state. The principles of socialism are laid down in TANU Constitution, and they are as follows. Wherein TANU believes all human beings are equal. Every individual has a right to dignity and respect. And so they lay out these 10 points. But what I want to get to is, because we're developing the political philosophy, so those are the human rights aspects of what Julius is laying down. But we want to get into further the structure of the state. Right? And we just go back, and if anyone has any questions on the humanist aspects of the Arusha Declaration, I definitely can cover that. But I want to get into the governmental structure because, of course, as you know, what we've been doing here is building upon the consciousness of, as Baba Kwame said, the unconscious, and then even those of the conscious among us so that we understand where it is that we're going in this journey towards the foundation of an independent state or repatriating to an independent state so that we can, as Baba Marcus Garvey just said, live free from under the curses of the imperialists. And so as a part of this policy in the Arusha Declaration, Baba Nyerere said in part two, the policy of socialism, absence of exploitation. A truly socialist state is one in which all people are workers. It does not have two classes of people, a lower class composed of people who work for their living and an upper class of people who live on the work of others. In a really socialist country, no person exploits another. Everyone who is physically able to work does so. Every worker obtains a just return for the labor he performs. And the incomes derived from different types of work are not grossly divergent. In a socialist country, the only people who live on the work of others and who have the right to be dependent upon their fellows are small children, people who are too old to support themselves, and crippled, and those to whom the state at any time cannot provide with an opportunity to work for their living. So if you're young, elder, or crippled and infirm, then you have the right to say, hey, I need some help. These are foundational principles. It doesn't say that you're going to have to pay for it and that if you don't have insurance that you can't get that help, right? These are the foundational principles, understand, of which government should be set forth upon. Also, the major means of production and exchange are under the control of the peasants and the workers. to build and maintain socialism, it is essential that all the major means of production and exchange in the nation are controlled and owned by the peasants through the machinery of their government and their cooperatives. Further, it is essential that the ruling party should be a party of peasants and workers. Right? So the people who make up the foundation of the government are not of the elite. They are those they come from, and they're further, the districts are designated and working in tradition with the local leaders, send their representative to that larger state body. Speaking of which, the existence of democracy. A state is not socialist simply because it means its means of production and exchange are controlled or owned by the government, either wholly or in part. For a country to be socialist, it is essential that its government is chosen and led by the peasants and workers themselves. If the minority governments of Rhodesia or South Africa control or own the entire economies of their respective countries, the result will be a strengthening of oppression, not the building of socialism. True socialism cannot exist without democracy also existing in the society. So the imperialist line of that their socialism being undemocratic nearly destroys with that point. You're always going to have a means of representation from individual communities in any civilized society. But that difference being that these exploitative relationships, particularly of capitalist Western governments and businesses, doesn't exist because there can be no exploitation of the people. This makes a major difference in the individual existence of people. If the people that are under the threat of the coronavirus know that the healthcare, true healthcare, is available to them without any economic price, then it would make a different mentality for the people. So you see how the system of government is responsible for what the mentality of the people is and how that goes forward. Further, Baba Niede says, do not let us depend upon the upon money for development. We don't need money for development. It's our labor that's important. It's that which they've been wanting to steal originally and are continuing to steal. Think about the example of Thomas Sankara. Think about the deforestation, the desertification, tactics that he carried forth. Only by the hands of the people, they just took sand and just kept putting bags of sand to make a wall so big that the sand couldn't blow over there no more. Then they planted crops on the other side of the sand wall, and them crops, they watered them, and they bloomed, and they turned the desert back. Then they tear down that wall and move the wall further back next year. And then they took back the desert by them efforts just off the might, off the strength of the people. And so when they're organized in that manner, you know, have to take for you to wait till somebody give you a job, and then you sign the application, get a social security card and driver license, and then wait till they call you and all that. It's like, no, in the community where you're at, where you live, you're going out there because it's going to benefit you, and you're going to have more land to grow your crops. And so that's the kind of symbiotic governmental to people. And then the government come, they supply the sandbags, they supply the shovels, they supply the trucks to move it with, right? And then that government to people relationship is built that way, completely free of, as Niela said, that economic exploitation principle, right? So that's how we reach development, and that's how we get to the point of independence economically and development-wise. The policy of self-reliance. Part three, Niede, I love this part. He says, we are at war. That is the quote that leaves off the paragraph. TANU is involved in war against poverty and oppression. It is our weakness that has led to our being oppressed, exploited, and disregarded. Now we want a revolution. The revolution was bringing to an end our weakness so that we are never again exploited, oppressed, or humiliated. The next paragraph has the title of "A Poor Man Does Not Use Money as a Weapon." These are governmental principles that Nier has laid forth here, but that transmit to the people. We're talking about converting the unconscious to conscious, laying African philosophical principle, political principles in place. Because it's obvious that in the past we have chosen the wrong weapon for our struggle, because we chose money as our weapon. We're trying to overcome our economic weakness by using the weapon of the economically strong, weapons which in fact we do not possess. By our thoughts, words, and actions, it appears as if we have said, money is the basis of development. Without money, there can be no development. Each year, each ministerial government makes its estimates of expenditure. Every ministry puts forward very good development plans. When the ministry presents its estimate, it believes that the money is there for the acting, but that Minister for Finance and his ministry are being obstructed. And regularly each year, the Minister for Finance has to tell his fellow ministers that there is no money. And each year, the ministry complains about the Ministry of Finance when it trims down their estimate. Right. They want the money, but it ain't here. Similarly, when members of Parliament and other leaders demand that the government should carry out a certain development, they believe that there's a lot of money to spend on such projects, but that the government is the stumbling block. Yes, such belief on the part of ministries, members of Parliament, and other leaders does not alter the stark truth, which is that government has no money. When it is said that government has no money, what does this mean? It means that the people of Tanzania have insufficient money. The people pay taxes out of the very little wealth they have. It is from those taxes that the government meets its recurrent and development expenditure. If one calls on the government to spend more, one is in effort calling on the government to increase taxes. Calling on the government to spend more without raising taxes is like demanding that the government to perform miracles. It is equivalent to asking for more milk from a cow while insisting that the cow should not be milked again. Yeah. And so these foundation principles within the Arusha Declaration lay out this foundation for the development of African government free from exploitation, free from loans connected to the West, free from a viewpoint that from the ministries that said the government should have all of this money. In other words, they have to develop strategies whereby which the strength and might and labor of the people are the currency, and that we don't look to the tool of the enemy for the development of our nation. This must be succinctly clear, because where we are right now, even in regards to on the continent, we're still stuck in that. We're still stuck in the IMF and World Bank loans and, you know, that whole game right now. We haven't broken out of that yet. So Nyerere gives us this overarching philosophy of development through the basis of African socialism, right? In which that philosophy from that time was further development into with Kwame Nkrumah and others, Sekou Touré, Amir Carl Cabral, and others into scientific social African scientific socialism. That is what that particular train of thought, those revolutionary governments, those revolutionary movements that had been involved at that period of time, culminating in combination of the African struggle with the African struggle, that in others, but also in the person of Kwame Ture, having been the as Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Ture were co-presidents of Guinea, serving as their secretary. And so that's why we open with Kwame, letting us know that it is our task, speaking to activists, speaking to organizations in regards to the direction that we go in relating to the continent and what is the overarching philosophy that we go forward with so that we can look to build a united front effort and already be clicking on cylinders when this thing jumps because we already are on the same page. And if we're not, then we understand that too. And that's very important to know also. And so kind of going back into our history to understand. So we heard Nieri, we heard from Garvey, we see the foundation of the African nationalism from the diaspora perspective thing we have to get from up under this imperialist government. We see the foundation of African socialism, African scientific socialism with Julius Nieri and the Arusha Declaration. And so we take a step back in history, right, to go to understand the developmental psychology, briefly, of the African, right, to take a ethno-philosophy perspective, to say that we are Bantu people, right? We are different tribes of people on the continent, you know, the Nilotic or what they call the Bantu. You had the San people, the desert dwelling, the Twa. And so from that, what we call Bantu philosophy, or Ubuntu, these principles, these things, philosophically, not culturally or religiously, but philosophically, as a way of living as people, right? I want to make that clear. We talk about Bantu philosophy. We talk about Bantu philosophy in its social context in regard to the relationship between people, tribes, and nations, right? Going back, just take a little step back in history, right? And so when you look at the origins of Bantu philosophy, you know, or ontology, right, that anthropological perspective of a people, the general notion of being, you know, that foundational principle, we're seeing that the Bantu soul hankers after life and force, right? The fundamental notion under which being is conceived lies within the category of forces. Christian thought in the West, having adopted the terminology of Greek philosophy and perhaps under its influence, has most generally been based upon the fundamentally static conception of being. Herein is to be seen the fundamental difference between Western thought and that of the Bantu. We conceive the transcendental notion of being by separating it from its attribute, force. But the Bantu cannot. Force, in his thought, is a necessary element in being. And the concept force is inseparable from the definition of being. There is no idea among Bantu of being divorced from the idea of force. Without the element force, being cannot be conceived. We hold a static conception of being. Being dynamic. A force. Dynamo. Bantu speak, act, live as if for them beings were forces. Force is not for them an adventitious, accidental reality. Force is even more than a necessary attribute of being. Force is the nature of being. Force is being. Being is force. When we think in terms of the concept being, they use the concept force. Where we see concrete beings, they see concrete forces. When we say that beings are differentiated by their essence or nature, Bantu say that forces differ in their essence or nature. They hold that there is a divine force, celestial or terrestrial, human forces, animal forces, vegetation, and even material or mineral forces, we must insist once again that force is not for Bantu a necessity, and that force is not for Bantu a necessary, irreducible attribute of being. No, notion of force takes for them the place of the notion of being in our philosophy. Just as we have, so have they, a transcendental, elemental, simple concept with them force, with us being. It would be a misuse of words to call the Bantu dynamis or energies. As if the universe were animated by some universal force, a sort of unique magical power encompassing all existence, as certain authors seem to believe, judging from their treatment of mana, wanga, or kanga. Such is an European presentation of a primitive philosophy that is but imperfectly understood. The Bantu make a clear distinction and understand an essential difference between different beings. That is to say, different forces. Among the different kinds of forces, they have come to recognize, just as we do, unity, individuality, but individuality clearly understood as meaning individuality of forces. So, here we understand the fundamental principle, the Bantu principle, that force is being. For the European being, concrete things is what represents force. Understand me. Because when you understand the foundational principles philosophically that people are coming to or coming out of as they're forming a government, then you can understand and everybody once again can be on the same page. So if force is the underlying principle of Bantu philosophy of force. Think about it. Just think about it. We're talking about government, but think about force. I know in our mind you think about force, the police force, force used against, but think about it. See how things reverse? We've been acculturated to think that force and violence and these things are against the principle of human nature and being. The Bantu philosophy says that force, not only is that force not separated from being, but you cannot be a being and not understand the accumulation and use of the instrument of force in your spirit, in your power, is your foundation principle of being. So when you accept that and adopt that in your heart and in your spirit, then you will be more in tune with those foundational principles of African being that we have been established upon, that we have been separated from. Force is being. If you're not utilizing force, if you don't understand that the whole power, he said, it'd be correct, don't call us energies. It ain't about the energy. It ain't about the energy, right? No. We're using force. We'll force be. We project. We don't sit. We're not passive in that as a foundational principle of a people. We're philosophical. We're visual. But underneath that, those things, even that vision, that word speaks out, these things have to be adopted as forces of our being that are foundational principles that we have to work from. So in regards to understanding where we are as a people and how the philosophy of the Bantu, which is that is what we come out of, and in the West, that diaspora community that has been captured from its mother continent in many and spread out through many lands through the West, and then coming back to and understanding those foundational principles of the area of African socialism, understanding that there is no way forward in liberation for African people without socialism, without African socialism, without African-centered scientific socialism. There's nothing. You can't call it nothing else. You can't try to reform it. You call it revolutionary pan-African socialism, but you won't have that socialism in there. And it's going to be revolutionary when you break it down to the principle that the foundation of it comes from. We ain't going to try to give us no pan-Africanism that's mixed with capitalism, where you just want to come and make some money, and you're not developing a system whereby which these resources can be taken to full market by the people who work it on the ground. That means no company comes to your country and extract the resources out of there raw, right, and go and take it and then sell it back to you. That means if they come out the ground because the workers and the peasants own the corporations or whatever business structure we set up in that type of society, that when the raw oil come out the ground, they're going to be the ones that work in the refinery, they're going to be the jewelers that make it into the final product, and then we'll sell it to whoever it is. We might want to just, we might have the children of somebody that put a little bling on it, or whatever the latest little thing about it, but every person in that society will touch it once and benefit off of it before it leaves from here. That's socialism. That's how you do it. The workers and the peasants owning the means of production. Right? And so what I wanted to do is just look at from the ground point, from the revolutionary perspective, from Comrade Amilcar Cabral, of course. So we're looking at the philosophy, and I want to look at it in practice here in regards to Comrade Amilcar, as we know, who was really one of the most intellectual of the underground revolutionaries, and he left us this volume. This is one of the volumes, Unity and Struggle, the speeches and writings of Amilcar. But from the African perspective, from on the ground, and we've covered weeks before Sankara and Nkrumah and others. And this is, I just wanted to dig a little deeper in the archives to give you another perspective of one of the comrades on the ground and how he presents from their aspect of struggle. Political reality, Amilcar says. The political reality of our land is that the greatest reality that we all know well is the fact that we are Portuguese colony. Our people could rule themselves neither in Guinea nor in Cape Verde. The Portuguese ruled even if they might appoint a black administrator, as only Honorio Barreto had the honor or disgrace of being. So Amilcar called out one of the neo-colonialists there, Honorio Barreto. And the truth was that the Portuguese ruled in our land, Portuguese colonialism. And it was this greater reality that created the conflict between us and the Portuguese. Exploitation of our people under the cover of Portuguese policy, this basically is what generated our struggle. Our struggle grew so much that we must take advantage of it to transform even geographical reality to the extent that we can. It would seem improbable, but it is the truth. For when we build dams, bridges, etc., we shall change the geographical landscape of our land. We are going to make a new human geography that we are creating in our land. When we completely transform the islet of Bijacos, when we make Cape Verde into a magnificent center for world tourism, for example, this will already be a new geographical reality that we are creating. The ship was now passed by far out to sea, we'll begin to stop there. But we must, through this struggle, transform the economic reality of our land. Let us put an end to exploitation by the Portuguese. But let us put an end to exploitation of our people by our own folk. And we must develop our land making progress as much as possible. This is what our struggle means. Social reality, cultural reality, everything is going to change. And already a new political reality has risen in our land, and it is following. We are ruling ourselves. Obviously, our reality has strengths and weaknesses, as I've already shown you. For example, the fact that we do not have great economic development is a serious weakness, but it is also a strength. For if our land had important mines, important factories, etc., the imperialists would have come into the war more quickly and in greater strength. Perhaps we should have had to fight not only against the Portuguese, but against other imperialists as well. And it is, at least we have acquired our lives, just bush and desert. Beautiful. Beautiful, Amilcar. Beautiful analysis from that perspective, that revolutionary colony there, and speaking of Cape Verde Islands and the development of it into a great tourist spot, and as we know now, right to exploitation, Cape Verde. And you can see this on any visitation or any research into that nation. So, looking at, as we are coming to our conclusion here, looking at the overall basis of the African political philosophy coming out of the diaspora nations, coming out of being captured following the tradition of Michael Garvey and those revolutionary organizations and nations. Myself coming from the Seminole, there being the Yamaski, there being the Garifuna, there being the Gullah, there being the Palenques, there being the Quilombos all over South and Central America. All of these revolutionary organizations, nations, and communities that have been dispersed through this Western Hemisphere. When we get to the point of that true Pan-Africanism that we speak of, the root that our political philosophies will unify around will be these revolutionary African socialist principles, this Bantu philosophy, and which is the use of force as being, when we start wanting to use force in our being in every way, and our enemy understands that. That revolutionary political African socialism, that Bantu ontology of thought that's force as being, and in your face, on the ground, either you're going to have to tell me to go away and go on with that black ish, but at least we give the effort towards knowing that each and every African person understood where we were in these diaspora communities, that Africa is the center, and that arms wide open and let's unite. What I'd like to leave us with is Comrade Diop, Chet Asa Diop, to be exact, in his volume, Black Africa, the Economic and Cultural Basis for a Federated State, which we'll be doing that one as just like a whole joint, because Diop in this joint, Black Africa, how many pages is Black Africa? 125 pages. But it's the most focused political analysis of the development of Africa that even to this day that I've seen, because the things that he talks about, developing the river valleys, right? So in this furthering of this African political philosophy, as we're speaking of, right, political unity and federalism. Understand these different, and we'll get into later on, these different forms of government. There's the democracy, there's the republic, there's the federal state, all these different territorial states, all these different forms of a state, right? But Diop said that political unity and federalism, the historical significance of national liberation movements and colonies, especially those of Black Africa, is no longer open to question. It is now readily admitted that this powerful decolonizing drive is as significant as the national movements of Europe during the 19th century. Apart from these colonies largely peopled by Europeans where resistance is inevitable, with few exceptions, there is less and less violent opposition to the development of the movement. The new tactic, rather, consists in trying to redirect, channel it towards non-socialistic forms of the so-called Western type, right? Like the opposite saying, trying to channel African governments towards the Western form, non-socialist, right? If this goal were to be reached, the former colonial powers and the United States might stop worrying. So Diop is letting you understand the move towards this capitalistic neo-colonialist state, as he saw before he transitioned in the 80s, right? That non-socialistic form of government, we just have to put it out of our mind. The unconscious are going to convert to conscious. They got to understand, it's got to be socialist. That's just all it is, too. I gave you Diop, I gave you Cabral, I gave you Nieri, I gave you Garvey, you guys, Dr. Clark. Socialism is the foundation governmental principle, African fundamental socialism, revolutionary scientific socialism, revolutionary pan-African socialism is the way forward for the revolutionary organizations in the diaspora, as been shown by us, by those revolutionary organizations on the continent and government from Angola to Zimbabwe and Zambia and Libya. And so we have to take and examine these things if we're serious about really either becoming a nation or repatriating to and contributing to our continental nation or the diaspora nations, whichever choice that we make, whichever direction, provide support, organizational effort to those revolutionary African socialist nations, provide support to those Latino socialist nations, provide support to those Asian socialist nations. Do your proper research. The Pan-African Revolution is going to be a revolution of a globe. Find every African population of people that you can. Forward to them the information of revolutionary African socialist organization and governmental struggle. This has been your combat reporter, Brother Tutmosis Fakar, here on Al Kibalon News. And remember, as always, African people, stay vigilant.
Black power, black power, black power. We want to thank
black
our
power.
Brother, our combat reporter, Brother Tutmosis Fakar, for his very thorough analysis of and laying out platform of African political philosophy. We have a couple of clips that we would play to carry out this discussion, to carry on this subject matter in particular. As we're doing this political education, we have a clip from Kwame Nkrumah, a speech he gave in Accra, Ghana, and we also have a clip from Kwame Ture. The clip from Kwame Ture is entitled Building the Black United Front. And so this would take us into the latter part of the program for tonight. We want to remind those of you who are listening, if you have a comment for Brother Tutmosis, to press 1 now so that you can be brought into the discussion. Press the number 1 and we'll bring you into the discussion. And this is the time to do it now. We have several people that are on. We got a few people. This is the time. Press 1. That way we know you have a comment. Press 1. Got a number of callers on. Okay. Brother Tutmosis, you laid out several statements ranging from the thoughts and the perspectives from Kwame Ture, Kwame Nkrumah, Amilcar Cabral, what was the brother's name in Tanzania?
Julius Nyerere.
And that document that you referenced that folks need to that he wrote, what was the document?
The Arusha Declaration, A-R-U-S-H-A, the Arusha Declaration.
Right. Now, right now, with the climate of what's going on the continent of Africa, we understand it's going through what folks are calling the Industrial Revolution. With the Industrial Revolution taking place, how are you seeing many of these doctrines from Diop to all the greats that you name actually playing out on the ground as far as the governments and the application of democratic socialist systems?
Well, everybody that's trying to put it in place, they're killing them. Mufumi, you know, the president of Tanzania, who matriculated into the office that Julius Nyerere vacated, right? That he transitioned out of, that he was also one of the leaders that democratically transitioned out of the office. He was voted after five terms, he left office. So the brother who was there in the place of the person who wrote the Arusha Declaration was just killed this year by U.S. imperialism. Along with Asian imperialism. Because he was in a beef with the United States. He was in a beef with the United States and China at the time when he was assassinated.
In regards to the COVID?
In regards to the COVID and in regards to the contracts of the Western corporations in Tanzania. He refused to let them do mass. He refused to let them do mass vaccinations, and he was nationalizing shit.
Similar to what Gaddafi was doing by nationalizing the resources and restricting
people. What was happening with him was because the economy kept dropping because of COVID. So he had to reorganize things. The couple of little contracts he had let the Western countries have, and they was cool on. He was like, "Nah, bro, I can't afford this." You know what I mean? So I got to get that back for him. You know. I can't pay, you got to send your tractors back. And, you know, he just was canceling projects that he couldn't afford because he had to worry about the health of the people. And then on the other end, the Chinese actually tried to make the man vaccinate, not the United States. United States' problem was the contracts and the money. Chinese tried to actually make the man do vaccination. I'm like, the Chinese tried to make people vaccinate themselves? But that's what was going on there with Mufumi, you know.
Well, we are aware that the development of the coronavirus through the NIH was a joint effort of the United States and China. We're very much aware of that. So what country or countries in Africa would you say represent the best system of democratic socialism?
Well, right now, I would have to, in spite of the transition of Mugabe and things that have gone on there, I still have to give it to Zimbabwe. The land reform program is the most revolutionary thing that's taken place in Africa. Every other African nation needs to catch up to Zimbabwe and do it. Every other nation, including Angola, where I was trained, they got contacts with the West that's lopsided. You know, everywhere else, everywhere, you know. Zimbabwe has set the standard, and they continue to.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And we are aware that Zimbabwe went under strict sanction by the state, by the West for their position. Okay, so now we have. How do we want to do this? Do I want to play these clips from Nkrumah?
Anybody who want to get, I'm gonna give the community. Anybody got a question? Anybody? Come on, somebody. Come on, let's engage. Let's talk about forming this. How we gonna form this government? Sister Crystal started off with developing the unconscious to conscious. I don't care if you ain't even been in the movement before, but what you heard, you have a question about. Don't be ashamed. We're not here to
belittle anyone. We ain't here to talk down on anyone. We just here to unite with our people and share knowledge. So I just want to get an opportunity. If anybody want to press the one, ask a question before Sister Crystal go into the clips.
Yeah, it seems like we got folks that want to listen more. So, that, okay, hold on. Oh, we got Brother Yaya.
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 May the peace of the Creator be
Black power.
Black power. Alhamdulillah. I have a question. I've been really inspired,
yes,
with permission, and alhamdulillah to hear your voice, Honorable Crystal Muhammad. It's beautiful. It's a blessing. I don't mean to be disrespectful. I have a question. I've been really inspired about the possibility of if in Africa there exist production companies, let's say, that honor our only resource, which is labor, and in a way that actually provides a substantial, beyond a substantial living for workers, because I've been really inspired about all of the solutions that are spread out amongst the African diaspora youth. It's just all of the possibilities that could happen with the what Brother Eugene Telford has shared on Thursdays. What I have learned was that Brother Eugene Telford was talking about all these engineering companies in Africa or in Nigeria already being
mm-hmm.
And, I mean, of course, this is protecting both Africa from that colonial disease. So I just wanted to ask, this whole temple that we've seen happening for the last 10 years with Kickstarter, creating this streamline with factories in China and Mexico, and then creating an industry on top of that, which only the people that were familiar with production schedules in China or Mexico and trade routes would guarantee the success of whatever developments were being presented by the people that were requesting funding. But now empowering the black youth diaspora, the African diaspora throughout the planet, to come together in one place where the distance between the engineers at the factories in Africa and the students, let's say students proposing solutions and new designs or et cetera, is diminished and brought together, and the solutions that would be presented, that the youth would bring, would be so transformative and so full of potential and nourishment that there wouldn't even be a needed discussion on how much the employees at the factories would be paid, so-called, and how are we going to protect the Africa from the continuation of mining and et cetera. And if that were to happen, do you think it would be destroyed, brother? I mean, Thutmose?
Well, I love this question. I'm writing notes like a mug, and I'm trying to answer every little part of what you're saying. Number one, the fact of what you said about Mexico and China, I love that shit, because obviously you have good information. What has happened is the worldwide manufacturing process of small goods, what I call trinket goods, right? Plastics, pottery, you know, little stuff that don't take a lot of technology. First, the United States, remember NAFTA in 2000? You remember NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement? That's when they moved all the factories and all that stuff to Mexico. And then in 2005, 2010, all the stuff moved to China, and then you start seeing everything made in China, made in China, made in China, right?
Yes.
And the resources for a lot of these goods, as you could probably guess, came out of Africa, because the trade agreements that have to do with this triangular trade between Asia, North America, and Africa, right? And so what's happened is, I feel that the Chinese because they have invested so heavily in the dollar that it's almost like, you know, we're questioning all of these things that's happening in Africa with China, and it's a give and take. We're getting development. We're getting roads that's connecting cities to other cities that never happened before, and they could make trade and all of these things happen. At the same time, we're not able to take advantage of it, and so making it better for Western exploitation. And so in order to protect Africa, what we've got to do is here as Africans in the diaspora, and from my position, I look at it as, Sister Crystal, you know that from the AU, my job is to the Legacy Project. I have to connect Africans in the diaspora with projects on the continent. Over here on this side, a lot of the work has to do with the unions. Like you said, the engineering companies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what I do is I study, like, Nigeria. I look at Lagos or Abuja or whatever city, and I'll see whether from the Stock Exchange, from the Financial Times or the Wall Street Business Journal, what American companies are operating there. I will go to those American companies' websites. I look at the officers in that company that might be black, study their background, see where they come from. They might come from the continent. They might come from the United States. They might come from the Caribbean. You know what I mean? But by studying it that way, I get to do a couple of things. Number one, if I'm bold enough to make that phone call, make that email connection, get to know that person, say, hey, look, bro, what you think about what the split is with the government and the company you're working for? You know what I mean? And then oftentimes it could open up these conversations, and then I could get the viewpoint from the inside of what's happening with that, right? Number two, what it does is by looking at these corporations, seeing the viewpoint, now I can see this these companies right here, this company called Freeport McMoRan, this company called Rio Tinto, this other company called Sino-Pacific, right? I can see that an American, a Caribbean, and an Asian country is working together in the same city center, and then look at if they're having conferences together, if they're doing economic development, they're cooperating with each other. And then go to Washington, D.C., to the embassy of that government and say, hey, you know these folks meeting and got these minds and doing this? You know what I mean? And then that way, in that position that I hold as the chairman of the African Union Diaspora Office, I can build these development relationships and then say, hey, look, I got some brothers over here, you know what I mean, that's some engineers that know about oil development and mine development and stuff, that you know, and here go they resume. They don't work for these white companies. The white company flew them all around the world, and they was the lead project engineer, and I've actually got people over there working like that. So that's how we have to do that work, bro.
Alhamdulillah. That's beautiful.
And
Alhamdulillah. Subhanallah. Allahu Akbar.
Brother Thugmoes, my apologies if I'm mispronouncing your name.
All good, comrade. Black power.
Black power. But I wanted to ask, imagine Africa Starts, that's sort of a name, to sort of point at a replacement for Kickstarter, let's say. And all of a sudden, that the designer, developer, or student, young African diaspora child speaking directly with the companies that will make these, materialize these visions from the youth, having that conversation, diminishing that distance, then it would demand that African-owned companies that are owned by the people. I mean, those decisions would not be made. Brother Thugmoes, one thing that you brought up with NAFTA, in 1996, I saw people in college, I saw professors get heart attacks. So one professor got a heart attack, another one got really agitated when they got the news that it was going to be passed. And it was in 1996 when these professors described thoroughly the exodus that would occur due to the displacement of all the Aboriginal peoples from Mexico and Central America and South America due to the North American Free Trade Agreement. And I just wanted to point out that the few products that are so-called are made in the United States are being made in Mexico and then just finished being assembled in the U.S. But I just wanted to ask, I mean, why providing living wages, if that was what the people of Africa would want to do, but to interface with the diaspora, but to protect. I'm sorry, but the reason that I'm having a hard time putting all this together is because the dissonance that I feel from the Earth observation system of satellite arrays that provides all of the farmers of the world their free plot analysis and predictions and health conditions of crops even before the crops show any signs, are the same ones that are scanning Africa and located all of the minerals, and therefore we're seeing the move and the shift towards now the eyes are of all the predators are looking at Africa. So I was just inspired by the fact that between you, Honorable Crystal Muhammad, and Brother Eugene Telford, there's already the infrastructure in place, which is the most difficult thing to achieve. And then once an interface, a simple website to replace Kickstarter is replaced, and it only opened up the channels for African youth and the African diaspora, with a focus on protecting Africa, not that it has been completely scanned and allotted and everybody has their bets. I just wanted to ask.
Look, bro. I can take you to where you can get all, they're called radiographic scans, right? And what they do is they fly over the continent and they project radio waves into the earth. And by the density of the waves that come back, they can tell what element is under the soil. The whole continent is done. The crap is just trying to figure out politically how I can get access to each one of them. But the other thing I want to say to you is this. Think about this, comrade, because you mentioned a couple of things. And I want to hear this in Kruma, too, because it's going to talk about this, too. But think about what is going on right now. Have you heard the news reports for the last year or so? The fact that there are African refugees in Mexico trying to cross the border into the United States. You have to ask yourself, how in the fuck, what the hell? How they get over there, right?
Exactly.
But like what I'm saying to you, you have to think about the triangular trade. Asia, Europe don't matter no more. That shit don't even count. Asia, Africa, Western Hemisphere. Refugees, resources, sex slave, traffic victims, all of this, triangular trade, right? So capitalism has created a system whereby which worldwide using with Africa as the center for the source of resources, us here as we continue to be the source of labor and slave victims, apartheid, medical apartheid, experimental victims, organ trafficked people, all of this over here. And the Asians over there, who are now becoming the new economic power in the world. So that is the triangle of the trade. You follow the people, you follow the resources, you follow the exploitation. And you can put it all together.
Thank you for
that. Where my little sister, Crystal? Where Brother Greg at?
And Brother Thugmos are... Family from Haiti ended up out here in New Mexico in Artesia.
Black power!
Black power!
Black power!
Black power! Yes.
Black power!
Black power!
Thank you, my sister. Thank you, thank you, thank you. They have you blind doors without my little sister hollering black power. I'm telling you right now, Brother Greg. I'm telling you right now. I never forget. I'm going to remember.
Black power. Sorry, I got
black
to.
Black power. And so
sorry,
without no further ado, you had something to say, Brother Greg?
I don't know. I was just saying, apologize for coming in late. Had to take care of a couple of things.
Hey, it's all good, my brother. I appreciate you. You was in place when it's time for you and the queen to be in place.
Black power.
And so without no further ado, Sister Crystal, would you like to introduce the Nkrumah clip?
Yes, sir. So we got about, let's say, 35 minutes. So what I'm going to do, I got a clip from Kwame Nkrumah that I will play. Try to balance it out here. I got a clip from Kwame Nkrumah that I'm going to play entitled Africa Will Unite. And then I'll follow that up with a clip from Kwame Ture. It was two clips from Nkrumah, Africa Will Unite and The Forces Against Africa. So these two clips are like 19 minutes. And then I will follow that up with a 22-minute clip from Kwame Ture in which he is speaking on converting. It's a longer version of converting. It's a fuller version of converting the conscious into the unconscious, which bring us back full circle from the shorter clip that I played earlier. So let's get this. Let's keep our political education rolling. We thank Brother Yaya for calling in, giving his comment. We thank Brother Greg and the Young Princess for calling in and giving us that energy. And most definitely, we thank our brother Tutmose Sankara, the combat reporter with Akiva Lawn News, for keeping this and the narrative exactly where it needs to be focused on. You know. So let's hear it. Kwame Nkrumah, Africa Will Unite.
Welcome to the Great African Leadership Series, where we feature great inspirational speeches and quotes from African leaders.
Fellow freedom fighters, comrades and friends, it is my great pleasure to welcome you to Accra and to this conference of African freedom fighters and supporters of the growing movement for Africa's liberation and unity. It is good for our cause to have a periodic meeting of this kind to examine our position in the great struggle to rid Africa completely and forever of imperialism and its handmaidens, colonialism and neocolonialism. Africa is rich and not poor. As the great wealth that has been taken out of our continent over five centuries of despoliation and extortion, very well put. Africa has immense actual and potential wealth, gold, diamond, copper, manganese, bauxite, iron ore, uranium, asbestos, chrome, cobalt, a host of other minerals. Our essential agricultural produce have all been drained away by colonialist imperialism. Africa is far from being poor. It is Africans who are poor, not Africa. And they are poor because of the uncounted profit that has been made out of the exploitation of their labor and their lands. If we are being bid to enter a European community, we must have something that community needs, and needs badly, when it pretends to offer a bonus by way of aid. When Greece come bearing grapes, should we not look them well in the mouth? If I may mix my metaphor, but I'm sure you get my meaning. I raise this point so that it will stay in your mind when you may be tempted by the seductive promises of new colonialism to forget the real character of colonialist imperialism and be persuaded away from your own true interests and those of Africa. For today, we must each see ourselves as part of Africa in order that we may face colonialist imperialism and its new form, new colonialism, on a continent-wide front. For unity must be the keynote of our actions. Our enemies are many, and they stand ready to pounce upon and exploit our very weakness. They tell us that this particular person or that particular country has greater or more favorable potentialities than the other. They do not tell us that we should unite, that we are all as good as we are able to make ourselves once we are free. Remember, always, that you have four stages to make. First, the attainment of freedom and independence. Secondly, the consolidation of that freedom and independence. Thirdly, the creation of unity and community between the free African states. Fourth, the economic and social reconstruction of Africa. This requires some plain speaking. And for the sake of Africa, let us speak plainly. As I see, our greatest danger stems from disunity and the inability to see that the realization of our hopes and aspirations, the realization of our objective of total African independence and of our future progress and prosperity is inextricably bound up with the necessity to unify our policy and actions in connection with the continuous struggle for independence and the greater task of economic and social reconstruction beyond it. We must therefore face the issue of African unity now, for only unity will make the artificial boundaries and regional demarcations imposed by colonialism obsolete and superfluous. African unity will thus provide an effective remedy for border disputes and internecine troubles. In a united Africa, there could be no frontier claims between Ethiopia and Somalia, or between Zanzibar and Kenya, Guinea or Liberia, or between Ghana, Togoland and the Ivory Coast. Because we would regard ourselves as one great continental family of nations. Some of the leaders, it must be confessed, do not see the struggle of their brother Africans as part of their own struggle. Even if they did, they would not be free to express their solidarity. This rift are consciously created by the imperialists between Africans, where they can sit back and watch with sly satisfaction, as well as contempt for those who fail to see how they are being used against Africa's best interests. Regrettably, those states include some who were among the freedom fighters of yesterday and who haven't won their independence, are willing to drop it for some token aid and thereby deny to those still struggling for freedom even their moral support. Here is a phenomenon against which all African freedom fighters must be on their guard and resist to the utmost. Even though I appreciate the difficulties facing us, I must admit, I find it strange to watch some of us returning willingly to the colonialist fold. This time, they don't even have the excuse of being forced to subject themselves to foreign domination. It makes one wonder, why so much effort and sacrifice and so many lives were given up to the achievement of independence in the first place, if it can only be so quickly and easily surrendered. We must begin to build immediately our own continental common market. For it is easy for anyone who studies the common market organization closely to realize that the common market is aimed at harnessing the African countries to satisfy the profit loss of the imperialist bloc and to prevent us from following an independent neutralist policy. It is easy to see that the imperialists and the colonialists are determined to retain the African countries in the position of suppliers of cheap raw materials. If we do not resist this threat, and if we throw in our lot with the common market, we shall doom the economy of Africa to a state of perpetual subjection to the economy of Western Europe. This will, of course, hinder the industrialization of our young African states. It is impossible to think of economic development and national independence without possessing an unfettered capacity for maintaining a strong industrial power. The activities of the common market are therefore fraught with dangerous political and economic consequences for the independent African states. The organization constitutes an attempt to replace the old system of colonial exploitation by a new system of collective colonialism, which will be stronger and more dangerous than the old evils we are striving to liquidate from our continent. This is another reason why we should come together in a unified African economic plan, which, operating on a continental scale, can make a solid attack on the imperialist domination in Africa. We should, without delay, aim at the creation of a joint African military command. There is little wisdom in our present separate effort to build up and maintain defense forces, which, in any case, would be ineffective in a major world conflict. If we examine this problem realistically, we would ask, which single African state could protect itself against an imperialist aggressor? And how much more difficult this would be when some states are allowing the imperialists to maintain bases on their territories. I have already referred to the military forces which South Africa is raising and the danger it poses for the new African state and the struggle of those still in chains. Only our unity can provide us with anything like adequate protection. Those problems can best be met within a unified Africa. And it should be possible in the higher reaches of our endeavor to devise a constitutional structure which will secure the objectives I have outlined and yet preserve the sovereignty of each of the countries joining the Union. Countries within the Union will naturally maintain their own constitutions, continue to use their own national emblems and national anthems and other symbols and paraphernalia of sovereignty. Regional associations and territorial groupings can only be other forms of balkanization unless they are conceived within the framework of a continental union. There are existing models which we can modify or adapt to our pattern. The United States of America, the Soviet Union, India and China have proved the efficacy of unions embracing large stretches of land and population. Long live African freedom fighters. Long live African independence. Long live your struggle. And long live African unity.
And share this video with friends and family.
The forces arrayed against us are, and I use the word most carefully, formidable. They are entrenched and powerful. They are, as I have taken some pains to explain, the forces of imperialism acting through their instruments, new colonialism and colonialism, ably assisted by the agents of the Cold War. They operate in worldwide combinations at all levels, political, economic, military, cultural, educational, social, and trade. And not all, and through intelligence, cultural, and information services. They operate from European and African centers, using agents who, I'm ashamed to say, are often unpatriotic sons of Africa, buying personal satisfactions with the betrayal of their country's safety and integrity. They seduce leaders. They seduce leaders of the African political, trade union, and people's organization, thus creating rifts and quarrels within the national front. On the border front, they are amassing their forces in a determined effort to stay the advance of African liberation and the march of unity. It is not accidental that the countries of the European Common Market and those spearheading the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the imperialist powers who have brought in their vassals, Spain and Portugal. Portugal, in fact, since the wars of the Spanish Succession, 1700 to 1714, being a protectorate of Britain, which has enjoyed special trading and unnecessary rights in both Portugal and in the Portuguese territories for over 200 years. It is not difficult to understand, therefore, why Britain has not raised a voice against the atrocities in Angola and other protected Portuguese territories and actually supported Portugal's preposterous claim at Goa in India was an integral part of the metropolitan country. The arms and troops that are pouring into Angola cannot be regarded as a solution from the international organization of imperialism and the Cold War militarism with which they are most definitely linked. It is absurd to think that Portugal, one of the poorest countries in Europe, could support so large an army, so well equipped, as that which is defending her colonial possession in Africa, without the active aid it must be receiving from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Nor can we look upon the way in which South Africa is busily building up an armed force equal to any held by the nations of Europe without sensing the international implications that are obviously involved. She has, we hear, a secret military pact with Portugal and the interlocking imperialist interests collected in the Congo and the Rhodesias, Angola and Mozambique, which are also linked with the great mining and financial interests operating in South Africa, create a chain of allies which seriously threatens
both the fight for extending African emancipation from colonialism and independence of the new African state. Now, that African independence has been achieved over a large part of the continent, and the national consciousness of Africans from north to south, from east to west, is adding momentum to the struggle for independence. Every kind of means is being used by the colonialists to arrest its progress and defeat its objective. They are attempting many methods, some sinister, some beguiling, to wreck our efforts. They strike antipathetic postures. On one side, they perform acts calculated to strike fear. On the other, they try to hoodwink us with fictitious gifts, which superficially pander to our hopes and aspirations. They are the president's attempts to deflect our purpose, to weaken our determination.
Black Power, that was Kwame Nkrumah. The two speeches that you heard excerpts from was the first speech was Africa Must Unite, and the second clip was a clip entitled The Forces Against Africa. May the great honorable Kwame Nkrumah's spirit rest in peace. And here we are 50 years later. His words are still as relevant today. Brother Tutmos?
Ashe, 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 oh. May the spirit of Kwame Nkrumah rest in peace.
Yes, sir, yes, sir. And
thank you for that. Thank you for that. Those were very focused pieces, and I haven't heard them in a while, and I was just sitting here in awe of the political intelligence of Kwame, speaking on neocolonialism, speaking on continental solidarity, speaking on, he said, if it wasn't for the imperialists, Ethiopia and Somalia wouldn't be fighting. If it wasn't for the imperialists, Tanzania and Kenya wouldn't be fighting. His political analysis speaks to us today. I really appreciate that, comrade.
And look how timely it is into what you were speaking on today. You know, that's
right.
What I'm saying. That was what, 50 years ago? And
yep.
We still have a long way to go, brothers and sisters. This is why it's important that we have broadcasts such as this, where we, you know, look into the political climate, where we look at the political positions we must take, where we look at the practical application of these principles that we're laying out, and we look at the what's actually taking place on the ground and what we have access to and the resources that we have available. So I want to keep it timely I was going to play a clip from Kwame Ture about the extended version, but I'll save that, and what we'll do is there's a clip here entitled Pan-Africanism, which is 10 minutes. We'll play that clip. We have to be able to adapt to the times. We need to use we have to elevate our conversation. This is the point I'm getting at. The majority of the information that is coming across on Western media is basically a bunch of buffoonery. You know, there's no content, there's no substance. You have a lot of symbol, you know, a lot of glitz and glamour with very few substantive conversation, very few substantive information. And here on the New Black Panther Party, radio, we make sure that you will get the exact opposite. Any presenter, host, or guest, or subject matter is intended to raise your political, social, and conscious, and spiritual awareness. So, again, we thank our brother Tutmosis Sankara for bringing us this combat report with our Kibbalah News every Tuesday night. We want to remind everyone that this Friday, is Brother Greg still on the line? We're going to have a very special guest coming on, the brother that's going to be coming on from Brazil, who was part of organizing down on the ground, part of the liberation movement that's been taking place in Brazil for years, will be on, and his name is Brother Marcelo Jose. He's going to be doing the translating, but we're going to have the brothers on from the National Security and Black Activism groups out in Brazil. Let me give you this brother's full name that's going to be coming on. Oh, man, they sent it to me in what is this language? Portuguese. But the brother name is Jose Adio de Oliveira, and he's the founder of Movimento Negro Unificado, which was founded in 1978.
I know him. I know him. I know him.
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. So the brother will be on the show. They will be on the 7th, Friday, yes. And so, and then on the 10th, next week, we'll have Brother Mawali Baruti on the show, who's going to be talking about the characteristics of a warrior. So we're coming into 2022 very strong, with very strong content, and we you know, we have every intention on 2022 being able to broadcast on the ground. We have in Africa, we have a few things that are lined up. As we start laying it out, we'll let you know. But this information that you're getting on this news broadcast tonight is not only timely, but it's going to have you politically astute as to what's going on. So, Brother Tutmosis, before I take us out with Kwame Ture, do you have any closing comments, sir?
Well, I just wanted to say, just to conclude off of what you were saying right now. Understand, African people, this is an activist broadcast. We're seeking for people to get involved with these things. If you have questions, you need to understand certain things, feel free. Please. That's all I would like to say.
That's right. That's right. With that being said, if you're interested in following up on any information that was laid out, hit us up at www.nbpp.org. Also, go to that same site, www.n, n is the new, b is in black, p is in panther, p is in party, nbpp.org, to join the New Black Panther Party, or to click the donate button to financially support the New Black Panther Party's radio and the other programs that we host. This broadcast is not free. We do pay a monthly subscription to make sure that this information is brought to you on a daily basis. So without further ado, we're going to close it out with a piece from Kwame Ture entitled Pan-Africanism, Black Power.
Pan-Africanism, what I'd like to do in the 20-minute period we have is to give you its general outline, its general development, and, of course, its future path. Some people think that Pan-Africanism is a response to colonialism. While certainly Pan-Africanism responded to colonialism, we must not think that it's colonialism that brought Pan-Africanism into being. Of course, to see this clearly, we should just look at the general evolutionary processes of all societies on a universal basis. All societies have a tendency to go from a smaller social aggregate to a larger social aggregate, from the family to the tribe to the clan to the nation to the continent. This is an evolutionary process. This theory can be seen in living practice if today we were to look at Europe. Europe everywhere speaks of European continental unity. Even though Europe has fought more fratricidal wars than any other continent or all the continents put together, Europe still speaks of European continental unity. Of course, Africa will unify before Europe, but that's not the point of discussion here this evening. The fact that Europe, with all the fratricidal wars she has fought, can speak of continental unity shows this evolutionary process. Africa, like any other society anywhere in the world, was involved in this same evolutionary process, going from family to tribe to clan to nation to continent. This evolutionary process was interrupted by European imperialism. It came in two forms, slavery and colonialism. First, they took over 300 million, the strongest, out of Africa, and then they divided Africa at the Berlin Conference. So you can see that Africa herself was moving on this evolutionary process. This evolutionary process, which would lead to continental unity, and Africa will still be the first continent unified, was interrupted by European capitalism. Since it was interrupted by European capitalism and evolutionary process, the only way that Africa can unite today is through a revolutionary process aiming at a socialist economy. If capitalism destroyed us, it doesn't make sense to use capitalism to continue with it. We must use the antithesis of capitalism, which of course is socialism. And certainly if the evolutionary process has been interrupted, the only way we can capture the time lost is through a revolutionary process. We state these facts only to let you know that those of us who are revolutionary, Pan-Africanists, is not because we love revolution. It is historically determined, and we have no alternative but to follow history and to use history for the benefit of our people. So this then is the general outlines of Pan-Africanism. So you must not think that Africanism just began. Had Africa been left untrampled by European imperialism, we'd have a long time achieved continental unity. Secondly, Pan-Africanism must be seen as a movement, a mass movement. And this mass movement must be properly understood. Africa, of course, because of racism, is belittled everywhere. And many people do not see Africa's constant, underline the word constant, contributions to world civilization. Since the 1940s, Africa has given, even before the 1940s, actually we can go back to the Honorable Marcus Garvey, Africa has given to world political movements a mass character. Africans revolt in masses, never as a vanguard party. If you look at the independence struggle in Africa, it was nothing less than mass. If you look at the struggle in the Caribbean for independence, it was nothing less than mass. And even in the United States of America, the only movement they call a mass movement is our movement. Therefore, this mass character must be properly understood. Pan-Africanism has this mass character. Africans have this mass character in responding. And our responsibility is to bring this mass character together, make it precise, so that it can direct its blows at the enemy, hitting him, until we knock him down. Therefore, the task of Pan-Africanism is to gather the masses of our people together in the same organization, irrespective of where they find themselves, be it in Europe, be it in the United States, be it in the Caribbean, or be it in Africa. This is the first aspect, then, we must understand. Pan-Africanism found its organizational expression in 1900. Here, a Pan-African conference, here the word conference, was organized by Africans from all over the world. They came together deciding that something must be done for Africa. One of the leading organizers of this conference was a man by the name of Henry Sylvester Williams, born in Trinidad, a man whom you should do some history on, a very, very great man. Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois attended the conference, but he was not one of the leaders in 1900. By 1917, 1918, the idea of a necessity for a Pan-African Congress, not conference, Congress, was to be called. But most of the people who did the conference were dead. Henry Sylvester Williams was dead. A lot of them were dead. Du Bois was about the only one who was alive. Du Bois recognized he had a historic responsibility to continue the work of Pan-Africanism, so he called the first Pan-African Congress. Make a clear distinction. The first one in 1900 was a conference. Du Bois, being intelligent, understanding that a conference is limited and a Congress has more elasticity and can go longer, called it a Pan-African Congress. From the 1990s up until 1945, we could say seriously, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois just about single-handedly kept the flame of Pan-Africanism alive. One thing must also be underlined to you. Pan-Africanism was brought into being in its organized form by the Africans outside of Africa. This was done only because of the oppression of Africa. At that time, Africa was under total colonial domination. There could be no political meetings. As a matter of fact, if you had the paper of the Honorable Marcus Garvey, you could go to jail. So the conditions were such that it was difficult for the Africans on the continent to organize. Africans off of the continent, recognizing this, came quickly to fill up that gap. So Pan-Africanism itself was brought to bear by the diaspora. But you must not think that the diaspora brought Pan-Africanism for the diaspora. Not at all. The center of the discussions has always been Africa. This must be properly understood. Some people try to shift it, make it take it somewhere else, but Africa has always been the focus. Du Bois carried on his congresses up until the fifth Congress in 1945. Because of time, we're just going through them quickly. In 1945, saw the fifth Pan-African Congress. Here, you had Africans born on the continent, in the Caribbean, and Africans, of course, born in Europe and the United States. At this fifth Pan-African Congress, there were three co-secretaries, of course, W.E.B. Du Bois, George Padmore of Trinidad, and Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana. So he had an African from the Caribbean, one from the United States, and one from the continent, who were co-secretaries of the fifth Pan-African Congress. The fifth Pan-African Congress is crucial for us. A decision was made there. They said that the final confrontation with colonialism is coming. After all, this is 1945, and you must know that there's negative and positives in everything. I remember once as a young man reading Mein Kampf on an airplane, sitting next to a woman. She said, what are you doing? I said, what do you mean what I'm doing? I'm reading Mein Kampf. Why are you reading it? I said, well, Hitler's a very important man. He had historical effects on the world, you know. She said, well, I'm a Jew. I said, have you read it? She said, no. I said, oh, that's bad. I said, have you not read Sun Yat-sen? She said, no. I said, he says, the first law of war is to know the enemy. If I were a Jew, I would read everything there is to read on Hitler. Of course. Of course. So while reading Hitler, she was arguing. I said, well, Hitler had some positive effect anyway. She said, what positive effect did Hitler have? I said, Hitler weakened European imperialism. He weakened the British, he weakened the French, he weakened the Portuguese, he weakened the Belgians, and that's how we got independence. And these are facts of life. These are facts of life. When Hitler got through with Britain, when the Indians said they want independence, Britain could do anything but get out the way and let them have independence. Matter of fact, they got Mahatma Gandhi quick because they didn't want to deal with the armed struggle that the Indians were preparing for British imperialism in India. And by the time India was free, well, it was over. China came up after China, of course, Africa throughout, etc., etc. And by 1960, in 15 short years of the declaration of the Fifth Pan-African Congress in 1945, two-thirds of the African continent was independent. You must understand clearly the importance of this. Now, at the Fifth Pan-African Congress, they said the only solution to the final confrontation is mass organization. And I say, if you look at Africans, we have nothing but mass character in our struggle. Of course, this mass character for the moment is spontaneous and must be transformed to something that is planned and permanent. But certainly the mass character is there. If you just look back to the Rodney King situation, those Africans who rebelled, rebelled en masse. They had no planning. That's how backward they were. They didn't think about it. Just on the spot, they said, okay, it's too much. Let's go. Let's get them. And everybody said, okay, let's get them. And we rise up as mass, and we get them. And then we sit down for 29 years. Of course. Of course. But the mass character is there, and we must understand this mass character. The Fifth Pan-African Congress, most of Africa, of course, was colonized. Kwame Nkrumah came to change all this. By 1958, he threw the British out of Cape Coast and named it Ghana. And Nkrumah declared before the entire world that the independence of Ghana is meaningless unless it's linked with the entire continent of Africa and its unification and liberty. And Ghana, and Nkrumah made Ghana the base for every movement that fought against colonialism.